Hello, David Rutledge with you, letting you know that while Hindsight won't be broadcast anymore, RN's new documentary series Earshot will still bring you features exploring history and much more. Here's a taste of what's to come on Earshot, and you can subscribe to this program now via the ABC Radio app, the iTunes Store, or your Android podcasting app. For more information, visit the RN website, abc.net.au/RN.
There are some people who still remember me. Not many, but a few. At one time, though, everyone in the colony knew who I was. Strange, isn't it? Who gets remembered and who gets forgotten?
I admire Esther. I'm sorry for her. I think she stumbled into an extraordinary new life. I think she was much luckier than her contemporaries. As it turned out, but it must have been a terrible beginning.
She must have been a very capable woman. Yeah. And it's just a shame that... Maybe not a shame, because she wouldn't have been out here if it hadn't been for her trying to steal that lace. So I admire her as a person, yeah. We all do, yeah. We think she was marvellous.
She was a Jewish convict who owned all of Annandale and half of Stanmore and became, for a time, de facto First Lady of this colony. I mean, I'm fascinated by her. She's probably fascinated me more than any female Australian historical figure.
Esther did things which I think were quite typical of convicts at the time, especially, I think, of women convicts. She just couldn't help herself telling lies. Lies for her own benefit.
A stout piece of lace, it was a short fall from grace. At 15 years old, a child sent away. A child I was, but a mother to be as well. A new gate jail was my baby's first home.
This is Johnston Street, Annandale, a suburb in Sydney's trendy inner west. I'm actually sitting outside my sister's house. My sister's name is Esther. It's the very same name as a woman who will be forever linked to this place, Annandale, but who was not memorialised here until very recently. Intrigued by who this other Esther really is, I'm going to travel across Sydney, as well as to Canberra and Melbourne, to try and pin this elusive woman down.
This is a woman's story and a man's dream. This is a gentle face in a good world. This is a woman's story and a man's dream. This is a gentle face in a good world.
I'm walking along Johnston Street to Annandale Public School, where the gates to Annandale House now reside. I'm going to meet up with Mary here, who can tell me a little bit more about Esther Abrahams.
Despite what they might say now, I never saw those gates. They were built after my death. They stood at the end of the drive, lined with Norfolk pines that led to my beloved Annandale. You won't find me there anymore, though. No one can find me now.
So these are the gates?
Yep. These are the original gates of the Annandale House, and the only monument anywhere that relates to the time Esther Abrahams lived in the house. They are beautiful, of course. As you can see, the sandstone is lovely, and they have the Johnston family crest on them. Esther was allegedly, at the age of 15, arrested for stealing 24 yards, that is two cards, of black silk lace in a shop in London. She was a milliner by trade. We now know she was pregnant, and we feel, many of us, that that theft, which was so out of character for her, allegedly, if it indeed occurred, who would ever know, was perhaps a cry for help or a cry of desperation. What hope did a 15-year-old unmarried mother have? We don't know much about the father. We know nothing, really. There's a lot of conjecture. And we'll never know. It's one of the great mysteries of Esther's life. never to be told.
Do you think she may have been married?
It was claimed she might have been. She certainly used the name Mrs. Julian later in the colony, but that might have been to protect herself. She was in an entirely vulnerable position until her marriage to Johnston. Otherwise, she was just his ex-convict partner.
Georgie Johnson had a pig. He hit it with a shovel and it danced a jig. All the way through Sydney town, he danced with Esther Abraham.
I left England as a convict on the 13th of May 1787 and met Lieutenant George Johnston on board one of the ships of the First Fleet. We had 8 children together, 7 who survived.
Georgie Johnson had a pig, he hit it with a shovel and it danced a jig.
And I see you've found one of the family. My great-great-great-grandson, Calvin Johnston.
Just in the family tree. Got,
it's big, isn't
it's got,
it?
Yeah, it's got 400-odd names on it. So it stretches about from here to that doorway.
It's like a scroll, isn't it? It's huge.
Sure is, yeah. This is where it all starts here. There's George's father, David, married Isabel Mackay, and now from Annandale in Scotland.
Yeah. How far back is it till Esther and George Johnson?
I'm fifth generation.
So they were your great... Great,
great,
great.
That's it.
Grandparents.
Yeah, yeah. Great, great, great grandparents. Yeah.
Esther.
You've taken a trip to Melbourne to speak with Rabbi John Levi, who's written books about me. In my time in the colony, there were no rabbis, and nary a synagogue. Though some people claim I kept a kosher kitchen. But a rabbi won't be able to tell you whether I kept a faith. Not now.
She actually had a long life, didn't she?
She did.
1771 to 1846 was a long time. Well, first of all, she must have been terribly tough. She was pregnant when she was arrested. Poor thing. Was so nervous she dropped the bolts of lace that she had tucked under her skirt and didn't make it out of the shop. And had the baby, which I think postponed things a bit, and finally ended up on one of the ships of the First Fleet with the baby, and might have got some extra rations because of that, and she lands with the baby, Rosanna, and gets very quickly shifted off to Norfolk Island with George Johnston, which isn't explicable unless they'd met and were friendly before, but whatever.
So you think they were friendly on the ship?
Oh, absolutely. Well, the ships were about the size of a Sydney ferry, so it's pretty difficult to keep separate, especially on the First Fleet, when they were really feeling their way. The link is challenged by Alan Roberts. He persuasively argues that relation should not begin until after the arrival of the First Fleet. Anyway.
Back in Sydney, I speak with historian Alan Roberts to find out when Esther Abrahams and George Johnston became a couple and why it's relevant. Do you think that Esther and George formed a relationship on the Lady Penrhyn?
Well, I doubt it very strongly. And the person who alleged this had happened, that they were shipboard lovers, and others have gone on to say Lady Penrhyn was a floating brothel. Absurd exaggeration. It's an important question too, because it could tell you something about George's character. The pregnancy, the conception of their first child is the first incontrovertible evidence that something's going on. And I've seen nothing earlier than that. That was around about April 1789, about a year and 4 months or so after their arrival here. That's the earliest demonstrable indication that they were then an item.
What do you think of Esther?
Esther did things which I think were quite typical of convicts at the time, especially I think of women convicts. One was having an alias, one was lying about her age. There's at least three different ages that Esther gave for herself. And being unreliable in what she said about her occupation. Now, we only know that she said she was a milliner. Now, if she were a milliner, you would have thought that one of the jobs that women convicts could do in the colony to start with was to mend clothing, because they had a shortage of clothing and very rough circumstances. Their clothing needed repair frequently. What we do know about Esther's occupation was that she was a hut keeper and a washerwoman.
When she got to Sydney?
Yes, that's right, when she got to Sydney. No, nothing to do with needlework of any kind. So on those three criteria, you'd say, well, her behaviour fits the pattern, the kind of characteristics of those people. I've had a close look at the record of her trial, and I think if I'd been on the jury, I would have had no doubt whatever that she was guilty.
A New South Wales bound on the Lady Penman we were. Below the waterline, 100 women, my daughter and I. At 16,000 miles, 8 months this dark, dank hole. Starvation and disease.
The next piece of the puzzle, as I try to find Esther, is a train trip to the Central Coast, just north of Sydney, to meet historian Grace Karskens. They talk about the Lady Penrhyn that Esther and George came out on as being a floating brothel. Is that true?
Well, no, not really, because it was normal in the 18th century for the officers and the petty officers and the sailors to have a partner with them in their hammocks and their cabins. In the 18th century, sex, I don't think it was thought of as a terrible thing. Actually, it was a normal human need, like hunger. So they didn't have the Victorian, and I think what we still have is this, ooh, sex is bad, ooh, you know, naughty, naughty, nudge, nudge. It just wasn't there. And so if a man took a woman as a partner, especially at sea where the rules are all different anyway, it wasn't thought much of. So what I'm getting at here is this is a different way to think about male-female relationships, and we have to strip away the later Victorian moralising about all this, and certainly we have to strip away this male-dominated historian's view of these women as useless and, you know, that they didn't contribute anything. Because in my view, actually, this is what drives this colony. It's men and women and passion and desire and the desire to stay here for that unit that they've formed.
Convict. That's the beginning of the story. And for somebody who was a woman, she really marks an extraordinary trail in early Australian history. Not only because she had pretty outstanding children, but also because she managed the Annandale farm. And it's a great embarrassment, I think, to Australia that they left the name Annandale on a suburb and then they destroyed the farm. It, you know, probably only by about 10 years when people began to wake up about Australian history. And it's terrible. One of the first most important farming areas in Australia. She looked after the farm all the time, I'm sure of that. She was the boss because he had other duties until he got into trouble, thanks to Captain Bligh and John MacArthur.
My George became the commanding officer of the New South Wales Corps. In 1808, he led the arrest of the Governor, William Bligh. That man had already lived through the mutiny on the Bounty nearly 20 years before. Some people never learn. For 6 months, though, my George was a Lieutenant Governor of New South Wales. And nearly 200 years later, one of our descendants, Sir David Martin, became governor of New South Wales too. I guess it's in the blood.
Georgie Johnson had a pig. He hit it with a shovel and it danced a jig. All the way through Sydney town he danced with Esther Abraham.
George Johnson is obviously infamous, I guess, for leading what's known as the Rum Rebellion. Are we seeing that in a different light now?
The Rum Rebellion? Yes, I think we are. It actually wasn't called the Rum Rebellion until the 1850s when people started to get obsessed with alcohol and rum and this whole idea that the colony had been awash with rum and rum was the reason for everything came to be about. And in actual fact, that was never all about rum. There was rum. Yes, people drank. Yes, that's it. The Rum Rebellion, the historians generally think now, came about more because Governor Bligh, who'd already been through a mutiny and had that reputation already, was trying to take away people's property. Mostly that property he was trying to reverse was leasehold. And you know what? He had a perfect right to do that. But having the right to do it and actually doing it in a practical de facto sense are quite different things, especially in old Sydney town, because people had already improved a lot of this property. They'd already, in some sense, put roots down. They'd committed to the colony. They were proud of it. They were proud of it. And it is very economic. I mean, colonies are all about making money, making a better life for yourself, basically. And in comes Bligh and says, right, well, we're not having this. We're going to reverse the leases. And, of course, the whole town in Sydney and elsewhere is terrified by this, because if you can take it away from the leaseholders, what about all the people that live in their houses with no leases? And so he's painted as a tyrant. And if there's one thing that English people, especially men, really, really hate and will fight against, it's tyranny. And tyranny in the sense of having your rights trampled as an English-born person. And I know it's ironic because these are convicts and ex-convicts, but they still hold dear to that idea of British rights from the Magna Carta. And so Bligh, who really doesn't have any people skills, let's face it, is a brave man, but he has no people skills and he does no sense of his own impact on other people. Maybe he had Asperger's, you don't know. Anyway, so there's this sense of crisis building up and building up and building up. And, of course, it's John MacArthur, I think, who does take the lead in this, even though he's not at the forefront, but he's still pulling the strings, I think. And I think poor old George was, well, he was the leader of the regiment. He's not someone who's aggressive or putting himself out there all the time. He's quite quiet, like a lot of them were like that. And I think that he didn't have a choice, really. They probably shouldn't do it. They could have been hanged for it. This is mutiny, after all. So there was George leading this rebellion. They did lock him up for almost a year. Bligh never recanted. He never realised the impact that he had. He complained to the end. George Johnson was court-martialed and he was lucky. He was stripped of his office, I think, and then he came back to the colony and retired to his property. So he was lucky. He could have been hanged. But I do think the court knew about Bligh and they knew what his reputation was and they could see what had happened. But he was lucky.
George Johnson led the colony, I guess, for 6 months.
With Bligh fuming up in Government House. Can you imagine what that would have been like?
Do you think, though, that Esther could ever claim to have been First Lady?
Well, they didn't really have that term. I think that's an American term, actually. But she would have been, yeah, the acting governor's wife at the time. Don't remember her being much of a socialite, so I don't think so.
There's Esther, but that was, I believe, taken when she was 56. To me, she doesn't look very beautiful there, but, you know, who knows in those days. But she is recorded as being the most attractive woman in the colony at that time. Yeah. You've got images of George as well, have you?
Yeah.
There's the painting. Right?
He was a handsome man, wasn't he?
So they say, yeah.
He looks a little bit like you.
Yeah, so they say. The family itself, in, say, the third generation, they were quite well-to-do people. There was money in the family. You can imagine how much money got handed down over the years because they owned so much property. You know? That faded out in the... that'd be the fourth generation. It would have faded out. There was three maiden aunts who didn't like the idea of her background and what he did in the overthrow as part of their pedigree. In those days, pedigree was very important. And they destroyed some of his memoirs, mainly to keep it quiet, perhaps, but, you know, but it was a stupid act, really. Because I think if those memoirs were available, we'd have a different idea of Australian history, I would think, yeah. His reasons for the revolt and various other things, I think, would have been destroyed. And his association with Esther, various aspects of her upbringing and life in England would have been probably written up by him. There's very little known about her in England.
I think there was a great shame in the family, even amongst Esther's children possibly, due to the anti-Semitism of the times and the embarrassment about having a convict ancestor that really lasted until relatively recently. Now everybody wants to have a convict ancestor, of course, it's fabulous. But I think it was a great shame to be descended from convicts for many people. And I think, yes, very definitely some of Esther's children and her grandchildren really repressed Esther's name and role. Her story is absolutely fascinating. I mean, she was First Lady of New South Wales for 6 months after Bligh was deposed.
Convict. First Lady.
Do you think Esther was the First Lady of the colony, the de facto First Lady?
Well, she wouldn't have wanted to be, but I think it just automatically happened. She was the wife of the governor. So you become First Lady automatically, I think. But I'm not sure that she wanted it.
Esther was a very retiring person. There's no indication that she acted in any public way as his partner, his hostess. I don't know of any occasion when she took part in a public event like a ball or a king's or queen's birthday celebration, nothing like that. In that time, 1808, it's a pure anachronism to use the term. So, you know, it's just something which people who want us to think the best of her will say, but it has no real meaning.
I never wanted a title, but I did want to make a new life for myself. And here in Australia, with George Johnston, I did just that. Together we own property. Lots of property, more than 5,000 acres. He called me his Etty. But he took his time marrying me. In 1814, after more than 25 years under the same roof, we finally made it proper. And I was Mrs. George Johnston.
Do you think it's surprising that Johnston took so long to marry Esther?
It does seem like a bit of a delay since they'd had a lot of children by that time and they'd built up quite an empire together. But it's not surprising in other ways because people think differently about marriage in this period, especially the officers who kind of set themselves up as the elite class. They have this problem. It's not really a problem till later, but they, yes, their wives do have, their wives, de facto wives, do have this convict background. They're all ex-convicts by now, of course. And in England, that would be just untenable. You couldn't do that. But in Sydney, it's so normal that it's all accepted. I mean, most of them live with these women. The women would have known each other. They would have met at social gatherings. You think about the mechanics of that. And they would have created their own little social world. It was much more relaxed, I think. I think the men did a lot of stuff that they enjoyed doing, like hunting and exploring and that sort of stuff. And I think they were probably happy. So why get married, really? And it's really only Macquarie coming in 1810 who starts to put the hard word on people. So it's a different world in terms of marriage. It was quite acceptable for people to not be married, but yet be committed to a relationship. It's much more, I mean, the rings bells with modern times, I think. So, but I do think Macquarie and possibly Esther herself had a hand in that, in the late marriage.
Why did he marry? It was because of that whole business about unmarried couples having to marry. And although Johnson was not vulnerable in terms of, you know, what would happen to his estate if he predeceased Esther, where he was vulnerable was his desire for more land and for other favour from the government. And Macquarie treated the Johnsons really as among his favourites. He gave them not just a whole lot more land, but gave them important positions in the local administration. So they did very, very well out of Macquarie's administration.
Esther would have had to have looked after the farm while he was away?
Some of the time. George Jr. had come back in mid-1808, so he was on hand by the time George left a couple of months later. And Esther seems to have had certainly a part in the management of the property. But by about 1810, the records we have, like signed advertisements against trespass and stealing of timber and so on, and records of the running of the property and sales to the commissariat, all indicate by 1810 that George Jr. was really the man in charge. So Esther had a part, a role, but it strikes me that it was essentially subordinate.
Basically, Esther and Elizabeth MacArthur did the same things. They ran their husbands' properties, they managed all their business, very capable women, both of them. 18th century, active women, wonderful. But I'm not sure about later on with Esther's history, but I know that people like Mary Reby and Sarah Cox, or Sarah Wentworth, as she became, were refused entry to Government House in the late 1820s and 30s, which is when you're getting more free settlers who had come equipped with the bogey of the convict stain.
She must have been Elizabeth MacArthur plus, I would say. Yeah. Elizabeth MacArthur was a capable lady also, but I think Esther was up there with her. I'm sure she would have been. Yeah. But Elizabeth gets acute us, of course, as being, you know, the lady who ran the farm and developed the sheep industry and all that sort of business. But Esther would have been in amongst all that. Yeah.
But as the corpses pile high, our blessings are many. Seven children and a home and a farm, though charged with mutiny.
Esther was smart, no question about that. She must have been appalled when she was accused of being drunken, incapable of running the state, having done so, having brought up the children.
So now it comes out. It always does. Was I insane, gaga and addled in the head? I certainly like my drink, but that isn't a crime. Yet once again, the law stepped in. Three trials in my life. For stealing lace, George's court-martial, and now this. I'll tell you one thing. I've got no time for lawyers.
I think it's where that red sign is.
There's one house where Esther spent the last years of her life that's still standing. It's in southwestern Sydney.
Port Church. Must be in the back garden then.
Built in 1837 by Esther's third son, David, the homestead at George's Hall is now lovingly cared for by the Hope Point Church.
Is that it there?
Yes.
It's beautiful.
Historian Alan Roberts has driven me from Johnston Street, Annandale, down Parramatta Road and the Hume Highway, essentially the same route the Johnstons would have travelled to the property.
To leave my beloved Annandale house for this. Oh yes, George's Hall may be beautiful, but it wasn't mine. All that I'd worked for was taken from me. For what purpose, you might ask?
Hope Point Church community pastor Jeff Allen is waiting to meet us.
Hi, you, Jeff.
Yeah.
You could spot us a mile away.
Lovely to see
you.
It's very cool. Yeah. Would you like to come inside?
Love to.
They forced me out of my beloved Annandale, my own family.
Just to give you an idea of what the place looks like from here.
One of the most beautiful homesteads.
Did they want my money? Or did they see some part of me I couldn't see for myself?
You'd know the story about Esther being declared insane. There was a trial, actually, or certainly an investigation, and they decided that Esther, even though she had lucid moments, she was incapable of running such a big operation. And she had gone a bit funny, if we can use that word, because when George died, she went off the rails a bit. She must have been very devoted to George. And she started to hit the bottle, which a lot of them did in those days. That was their solace, alcoholism. And she was gaining a reputation of doing for doing silly things. It's like driving a horse and buggy at 100 mile an hour down the main street and mixing with her old Jewish cronies. And it didn't go down well with the family. So the family generally were against her.
Convict. First lady. Lunatic.
Things really started to unravel for her after George Johnston died in 1820. And all that culminated in the case brought against her for being insane in 1829. They weren't intending to have her locked away in an asylum and throw away the key, anything like that. They still were responsible for her and accepted that responsibility, you know, happily. But they wanted to take control of the management of Annandale out of her hands, and the only way was to have her declared insane, unable to manage her affairs, and for the management of the estate then to be placed in the hands of trustees, who, as it turned out, were Robert and David. She used to be driving from Annandale into Sydney and back again at all hours of the day and night at a furious pace. There was no rhyme or reason to it, and this would sometimes go on for weeks on end, this kind of what Dr. Bland called his excited behaviour. I think it's unquestionable that her behaviour was very, very odd. Whether it was technically insane, I couldn't say.
Could have been related to alcohol as well?
Oh, yes, I should think so.
All I wanted to do was go back to England. At least one of my boys did the right thing by his mother.
So she eventually got out under pressure and lived with the third son, David, at the homestead. So that's where she saw her life out, at the age of 76, which was a great age for people of that era. And she was, and this is family folklore, if you like, that she was had access, or she was given a beautiful attic room, the homestead overlooking the property, and she spent her last days peacefully with a bottle of rum for comfort. So that was the end of Esther. Yeah. And the property, much to the chagrin of Commander Robert, was put in the hands of administrators. So Robert didn't get it. He only got it after Esther died. So he had it eventually, but he didn't get it when he wanted it.
I think all those claims later made to rid her of her position at the Annandale farm were pretty pathetic in view that it was all male. The judges were all men, the jury was all male, and they all liked a tipple, well, most of them, so the whole thing was a bit of a beat-up, wasn't it? Rather unjust. But Esther was no walk in the park. I believe very much that she was in her stage of menopause, which only women over 50 understand. I also have a strong view about the use of alcohol for women of the time, in that many women used alcohol because they had women's problems, menopause, menstruation issues and all sorts of similar problems. And there wasn't much medicine, and alcohol would have been a great palliative. Why did the alcohol issue have to be made such a thing of?
I certainly like my drink, but that isn't a crime.
I don't think she was insane. There was no reason to think that she was. She might have been a bit elderly, but I don't think she was dementing. And the family looked after her. And they buried her in the family plot.
I'm guessing this is the best way to go, but I think we'll be able to spot it reasonably well. So. Well,
quite prominent?
Yes, it's reasonably distinctive.
Ah, so you've found your way to me at last.
It's not that one there, is it? Just ahead?
Yeah, well, first you can see with an angel.
Yes.
A hand outstretched, I think that's it.
Here at Waverley Cemetery, overlooking the ocean, not far from Sydney Town. It's peaceful. My final resting place.
Sacred to the memory of George Johnston of Annandale, and then various details, and then you see it says Esther, also Esther, relics of the above.
I'm looking around to see if there are any other Esthers.
I think one of David's daughters they called Esther, and no other Esther was so called in the following two generations, so only one Esther in three generations following Esther Johnson.
Do you think that shows something about Esther?
Yeah, I do, yes. I think David is, I would think, was the closest of the boys to her. But I think they'd all been sufficiently alienated by her behaviour that they didn't want to perpetuate the name. Because none of them spoke up for her, it seems, at the inquiry into her lunacy. They, as far as I can see, all the evidence is one way. But all that evidence was on the first day, and we have no record of that. You seem a bit emotional.
Well, I've spent a long period of time, talking to people about the Johnsons. It's interesting to see their fault. Makes me wonder, that's a lot of history in there.
Mm. Yes, well, it goes right back to the beginning of Whiter's settlement, doesn't it?
Yes. Yes, it does.
Can you see them in the history of Sydney now?
I think that Sydney is absolutely drenched and studded with the names of the past. It's everywhere you go. I mean, every street. I mean, most people don't realise this, but when you start looking, the past is with us still. It is in the names. They're embedded in our everyday world. And words like Annandale, I always think of Esther and George, because that was the name of their property. Johnston Street, of course. And I think that happens in local areas too. I mean, if you just look in a street directory, you'll find all the early settler names in the street names. The streets of our city are named after governors. Blythe is the shortest street. I think Macquarie was having a bit of a joke there. The best street is Macquarie Street, of course. So you can also read both people's ambition in naming things after themselves or their friends or who they want to flatter, But you can also read in names what gets remembered and what gets forgotten. So I'm not aware of there being any Esther Streets in Annandale. So who gets remembered? The man, the officer, not the wife, the ex-convict, even though she contributed probably more than he did to running those properties because he was away being court-martialed or away on business or whatever. What they left or what they worked for and what they invested in the place, there are traces of it.
This is a gentle face and a good man. This is a woman's story and a man's time. This is a gentle face and a good world. This is a woman's story and a man's time. This is a gentle face and a good.
Singer Katie Noonan there with her own composition about the extraordinary former convict made good, Esther Abrahams. And you've been listening to Convict First Lady, produced by Ruth Barron. The supervising producer was Michelle Rayner and sound engineer Mark Don. The voice of Esther was brought to life by Alison Bell and the music performed by Warren Fay and Adam McCauley. Thanks for downloading this RN podcast. And while Hindsight won't be broadcast anymore, RN's new documentary series, Earshot, will still be bringing you features dealing with history and much more. You can subscribe to Earshot now via the ABC Radio app, the iTunes Store, or your Android podcasting app. For more information, visit the RN website, abc.net.au/RN.